So I want to talk today about Gene Hackman. Never met the guy, liked some of his movies, but something strange happened. And that was when I saw a picture of him. Apparently it was one of his last public appearances. He was going to a restaurant in Santa Fe, New Mexico, and he was walking across the street, and he's 95, or was 95. And if you didn't know that was Gene Hackman, you wouldn't know that was Gene Hackman. And he was thin. Apparently he was using a pacemaker. His wife had a diet for him all lined up. And he had a cane, and his body was bent over, and he was walking across the street. And I realized that was the guy that died. But on the news, all you saw was pictures of him from his movies. And he was in his 20s and his 30s and his 40s and his 50s. That guy didn't die. That guy didn't die. It was the old guy that died. And I thought to myself, isn't that interesting? And the question comes to mind, well, who dies? Who dies? And one of the things we all have in common is that we too will be dead one day. And are we ready? Probably not. Even people that say they're ready probably aren't. So, coming to the who in Buddhism, I say, okay, what is that? What is that who? What is that person? What is that ego? What is that self? Where does it exist? And the Buddha went in and said, well, there's name and form. He said there's 32 parts of the body. He said there are five aggregates, but there's no one thing. There's no one person there. There's no person there. Now, at the time of the Buddha, 2,600 years ago, in India, there was a person, and that was the soul. And when you died, your soul, your piece of the soul, went and merged with the mothership soul, the giant soul. Okay. But the Buddha said, you know what? I don't think that's right. I haven't found anything that exists apart from the process of what we call us. That is simply a process, and it's conditional. There's a lot of parts and pieces that need to be there for it to work. And if you take too many parts and pieces away, it doesn't work. Example, if you stop breathing for 5 minutes, you're dead. If you stop drinking water for 7 or 8 days, you're dead. If you stop eating food for 30, 40, 50 days, you're dead. So we have certain conditions required for our life to continue. And if you take too many of those away, you go, wow, it's not going to work. So what are the five aggregates? What did the Buddha mean when he said the five aggregates basically defines us? Okay, they are form, sensation, perception, volition, and consciousness. So let's break it down. Number one, form, body. Okay, we all have a body. That's how we're recognized. And we give it a name. We give our bodies a name. There's Susie and Sam and Joe. And that sort of defines us and lets people see us apart from all the other people in the world, or the close to 4 million people in Los Angeles. And then we have consciousness. Now, they put consciousness at the end, but form, name and form, that would be form and consciousness. And the consciousness they're talking about is just a rudimentary consciousness. It's just simply an awareness. So if you've been in an accident and fallen unconscious, nothing works. You can't hear anything, you can't see anything, you can't feel anything. And then when the consciousness comes back, you become aware again. So this is a raw consciousness that allows us to be aware, but not aware in any specific way. That's where we go into sensation. Now, our sensations sort of drive us. and make us aware of things as they go on. And you might say, well, how many sensations do we have, Kusala? And we have three sensations. I love that because it's just so simple. So we have the good sensations, and we have the bad sensations, and then we have the neutral sensations. And the thing about the neutral sensations is they don't really catch our attention. So we can just sort of like miss that. But the good sensations, oh, we're right on top of it. And the bad sensations we're trying to get rid of as quickly as possible. So that's how it sort of all starts for us. So we get the sensation, for instance, you're walking down the street and there's a bakery and you smell the bread baking, and that sensation through the nose, through the sense door of the nose, triggers something. So now we have perception and volition, concepts and activity. So perception, that sensation triggers our perceptions. And what happens remarkably is we start to hallucinate. Not a big LSD hallucination, just a small bakery hallucination. That we can picture other bakeries that we passed and gone into, and we can imagine the bakery counter with all the breads and biscuits and rolls all lined up, and we can imagine all that without even going in to the bakery because we've had previous experiences and we have words. And the words allow us to create our reality. And if you have a lot of words, you have a very specific reality. And if you only have four words, it's rather vague. So we got these words happening and we've got these pictures in our head and we're hallucinating. And we say to ourselves, well, I got an extra $2. I'm going in and see what I can buy. Volitional activity, those perceptions that we had, now cause us to go in and look at the bakery goods and perhaps even purchase one. Reach into our pocket, bring out money. All this stuff is a concept. There are no pockets in the world. We made that up and we gave it a word. And there's no money in the world. We made that up and we gave it a word. And so here we are living in this fantasy. But that's our life. That's our relative reality. And then you might say, well, what's more important, activity or perception? Concepts. Well, they work hand in hand. They're both really good. But if you ever want to do community service, you're going to have to get off the couch and go outside and participate in making the world a better place to live. Because no matter how grand your intention is, without any kind of activity, it's just a thought. It's just an idea. It just makes you feel good. What a great thought I just had. I can go out and save the world. And then you turn on the television and get a beer, and life goes on. So sometimes you have to get out there and do some work. But can you do it without being anybody? Well, ultimately, yes, but it helps to be somebody. So back in the 1990s, I became somebody. Until then, I was just a Buddhist. Okay, took the precepts, took the refuges, took the ordination, became a Buddhist. But how did that translate into activity? Well, it didn't. I'd walk into a room, I'd be quiet, dignified. They'd say, who's that guy? He must be a Buddhist. I can tell by the way he's walking. Okay, cool. But I had my picture in the LA Times. I was giving a talk in Cal Poly Pomona to the Buddhist Club, and there was a LA Times staffer there with her photographer. I got my picture in the paper. I went from being nobody to being somebody. And what happened? The phone started to ring. Hey, we saw your picture. I'm at LA County State Prison for Men. My name is Deacon Szymanski. Can you come up and help us? Can you come up and do Buddhism and not just be Buddhism? He didn't put it in that way, but that was the sort of the general idea. And I said, sure, I'd like to do Buddhism in prison. How many Buddhists do you have? Well, it's hard to say. We've got a few Buddhists. And I said to him, frankly, I said to him, I didn't know Buddhists went to prison. He said, yeah, they do. So for a year, I was up there doing Buddhism. Cool. So not only was I being Buddhism, I was doing Buddhism. And learned a lot. You don't learn much just being something. You have to learn it by doing something. And then I got another phone call from LA County Juvenile Hall. Hey, we saw your picture in the paper. Can you come up and help us? I said, do you have any Buddhists in Juvenile Hall? He said, well, no, we haven't found anybody yet, but we have a lot of young people that are suffering. And I understand Buddhism is about suffering and the end of suffering. It would be wonderful if you could come up and just give a talk and see if you like it. And then we could arrange a schedule for you. So I went up and gave a talk. And, you know, I felt immediately comfortable as I walked into the room because every guy there had my haircut. I'm going, okay, cool. We got that in common. And then I said, hey, is there anybody suffering? And all the hands went up. I thought to myself, I'm in the right place. So I was there for like 5 years doing Buddhism. Got other volunteers to help me. We had meditation. We had Dharma talks. We had questions and answers. They had a lot of questions. We had a few answers. And it was a good experience. I even got Volunteer of the Year Award from the probation department. Come on. You don't get that by being a Buddhist. You get that by doing Buddhism. So I started to see the activity of Buddhism is even more important than simply being a Buddhist. But that's where we all start. We all start. Some of us don't take the five precepts. Some of us don't take the three refuges. But some of us have read a couple books and think, yeah, I could be that. And then we sort of feel comfortable by naming ourselves as a Buddhist. So now the question comes to me with Gene Hackman, well, who died? And so we know when a person dies, their body dies. And I don't think their body is surprised at all, because I don't think their body knew it was alive in the first place. It was walking, it was talking, it was, you know, and, you know, I mean, does my index finger fear death? I doubt it. Okay, but then we have this thing called a self, this ego thing. Wow. Now that, the job of the self is simply to keep us alive. You know, and it's really concerned about us all the time. And we're the most important thing in its life. We're the center of its universe. And I don't know if you've ever had the feeling of sitting in meditation for 20 minutes or 40 minutes or even an hour. And you realize at some point this could be the end of your life, because now your ankles hurt, your knees hurt, your legs hurt. You may never, ever walk again. And nobody's going to care because they all got their eyes closed and can't see the pain and suffering you're going through. And then the gong rings and the self goes, oh, I didn't die. And you get up and walk around and have a cup of tea, and it's like it never happened before. But we get into those places where the self gets really nervous because it could be the end of its existence. So the problem with dying and who dies, it's the self that is concerned about dying, because that's the who. That's the who. So when all the meditators are out there and they're all sitting around meditating, what are they practicing? They're practicing to let go. Let go of whatever they were going to do for 20 minutes. You're not going to do the laundry. You're not going to watch the Oscars. You're not going to have a cold drink. You're just going to sit there. You're going to let all that stuff go. How does it feel? Sometimes it's very difficult to let it go because you know you should be doing something. That's it. That's the great problem we all face, is we know we should be doing something. And our job is to figure out what we should be doing. It's very rare just to sit around and do nothing. The problem with doing nothing is you never know when it's over. That's a big issue. So how long can you do nothing? Well, I thought I can do nothing for like a really long time. So one day I woke up early and I just sort of laid around in the bed and did nothing. And then you know what I had to do? I had to go pee. I had to do something. Oh my God. So we only have a certain amount of time when we can do nothing, and then our body wakes up and says, no, you got to do something. I'm hungry. I want my first cup of coffee, whatever it is. And then you've got that to-do list on the desk. I've got Vons to go to. I got laundry to pick up. Da, 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 da. Okay, and then your day just sort of manifests with all this doing. And can we ever stop in that process and just not do anything for a while? And that's where meditation comes in. Just sitting around doing nothing. A bunch of old people sitting around doing nothing. Yeah. And then we go back to doing something. And then we have to die. And you say, well, who dies? I guess the self dies, because the self realizes it's alive, realizes its existence is dependent on the body, and looks at the body as really as a dumb vehicle, unaware of everything around. And the self's job is to make sure the dumb vehicle does what it's supposed to do, like not walk into the wall, be careful when you're going up steps, all those things. And the self is there all the time. So now it's time to die, and the body dies, and the self dies. And what's left? Well, if you were a Hindu or a Christian, you would say, that's an easy answer. It's the soul. It's the soul that's left. But you're a Buddhist, and there is no soul, according to Buddhism. And if you disagree with that, it's okay to have a soul, because most people want to have a soul. But that's not who you are, according to Buddhism. The soul is not who you are. So what do we have instead of a soul, you might ask yourself? We have karma, karmic energy, produced by thinking, speaking, and acting. So remember, we have perception and volition. Well, perception works really good in the present moment because it allows us to understand and analyze and choose what to do next. Okay? But the activity that comes out of that is producing results, producing consequences, and those consequences will live long after we are dead. That's our legacy. Our karma is our legacy. So as we are not dead today, we can say, man, that's important to have good karma. I need to speak more skillfully. I need to think more skillfully. I need to act more skillfully, because that's my vehicle to the next lifetime. Now, it's said the Buddha could look back thousands of past lives and see exactly what happened, see how he lived, see how he's born, see how he died. And can you imagine having a teacher who could look back at even 100 past lives and know exactly what to do and what not to do? And can you imagine a teacher who could look at you and see 100 of your past lives and see exactly what to do and what not to do? And that's what they say about the Buddha, is he could look at you and he could see your past lives and he could tell you what to do now, how to find release from suffering. Wow, cool. So here we have this karmic energy now, and it's out there floating around. It's been released. It's free. But it needs to have a next lifetime. So it's looking around. And they say, when it's looking around, it's looking for dark, moist places. Okay, cool. So now it's looking around, and dark, moist places, and it can't find anything really. And all of a sudden, it notices these two people over there, a man and a woman. And they're married, and they're in love, and they decided to have children. And they're working hard at it. And the karmic energy is drawn to that and drawn in and merges with the sperm and the egg. So according to Buddhism, we need three things to create a life: sperm, egg, and karmic energy. And that's when the life begins. And now 9 months later, it's released into the world. And you might think to yourself, well, you know, if you have really good karma, maybe you'll be born in Palos Verdes, have a nice car, great high school, good football team, you know? And maybe if you have bad karma, you'll end up in Koreatown, in a small place, a New Hampshire boulevard. And you go, oh, yeah, okay, you know? And then the problem with karma is the problem with everything. It's always changing. And Nietzsche, constant state of change and flux all the time. So even if you start off really good, no guarantees it's going to end that way. And even if you start off really bad, no guarantees it's going to end that way. So as we reflect on the importance of life and skill and the Dharma, we start to see that, yes, I have choices to make. I have choices to make. And the choices I make will not only affect this lifetime, but all future lifetimes. Now, when I heard this story the first time, I said to myself, well, you know, did a person who dies 3 days after birth have bad karma? Is that the reason they die? And my teacher said, no, that's not the reason. He said, for anything to happen, it takes at least 1,000 conditions. Okay, so the karma was one of the 1,000 conditions necessary for the little guy or gal to die 3 days later. Somebody asked me when I was giving a talk a few months ago, well, in your community service, did you ever save anybody? No, I never saved anybody. Because I was only one of the contributing factors. There were like a lot of other contributing factors that needed to be in place for anything to change in a positive way. But my commitment was simply to show up, not to save anybody. And maybe somebody, you know, got benefit from my being there. I never heard of it. They never shared it with me. But it's a nice thought to have, even if it's false. And so you go, okay, yeah. So everything takes a lot of things to just make one thing happen. And it's never one thing. It's always a unity, a process that's manifesting in the present moment. Fascinating stuff when you get into it at this level. I don't know what it all means, you know? That's the problem. It's just too complicated for the normal human being to understand. Maybe the AI robots will understand what we're talking about. The robots are pretty smart, you know. If you ever read Isaac Asimov's iRobot, you know they're going to take over. But that's another story. So here we are. We're contemplating our life and our future. And we look at Gene Hackman and we say, you know, the old guy died. And some of us will get really old and die, and some of us won't get really old and die. But there's no escape from that. But we can prepare. We can get ready every day by a little meditation, understanding the context of life. In this case, it would be in the Dharma and how the Dharma can affect this life and all future lives. And then you might say, well, will I be reborn forever and ever? Is there any way out? And yes, there is. There's one way out. There was also, I think, a movie too at one time. There's one way out, and that way out is nirvana. Because it is said when a human being achieves nirvana, they end their suffering right there. So you don't even have to die to end your suffering. A lot of people who have a religion where you have to die and get your reward, this religion says you don't have to die to get your reward. It can be right now in this very present moment. When you achieve nirvana, you end your karma. Wow. Now, what does that mean? If you achieve nirvana and end your karma, there's nothing to be reborn again. Okay. So you'll never have to go through birth, sickness, old age, and death again. But you might say, well, does that mean I'll be nothing? It's hard to imagine. If there's no heaven and no afterlife or no anything, other than Nirvana, which nobody knows what it is because the Buddha never explained it to us because we couldn't understand it anyway. You know, it's like being a turtle in the pond and the fish keep asking the turtle, what's it like to be outside the water? And no matter what the turtle said, the fish couldn't understand because it can't leave the water. So here we are, we're trying to understand Nirvana, and it's just like, can't do it, you know? Zen master once said, the point is not to find the answer. The point is to lose the question. So maybe we don't need to have as many questions because we can't understand the answers even if they are answers to it. But Nirvana, the end of suffering, the end of karma, the end of all future rebirths, and no matter what kind of Buddhism you study, that is the end goal. But until you get there, you got 32 heavens and 32 hells to contend with. You know, so we got a lot of places to go. We got a lot of things to do. And that's the joy of being alive. There's always something to do. When you're dead, not so much. I'm going to end there. And does anybody have any questions or comments about what I said or what I didn't say? Hand up. Yes. If we don't have a soul, what is it that
lives on?
Karmic energy.
Lives on.
Karmic energy. The karma goes from lifetime to lifetime to lifetime. And it goes into the heaven realm, and it goes into the hell realm. So it's the karmic energy rather than a soul. But when you hear people describe karmic energy, it often sounds soul-like. It often sounds like its own little entity. And it's supposed to be more of a process than an event. The soul, in my mind, is an event. Karmic energy is a process. And that's what goes on. And the problem for us with karmic energy is there's no self. There's no identifiable features that resemble us. It's simply energy in a process. And that really bums out a lot of people because they want to go on, you know? And if you get to go to heaven, you get to see your old dog, you get to see your parents and best friends. They're all up there and you recognize them and they recognize you. How wonderful that idea is in that thought. And here we have karmic energy, which is a process that has no particular form or consciousness, you know, and so we'd be unidentifiable. But that's sort of the point with Gene Hackman. If you see pictures of him when he was 20, and pictures of him when he's 50, and pictures of him when he's 95, that wasn't the same guy. Those are three different guys. And in between those three different guys are 1,000 different guys. And every day we are alive, we become new and fresh and for the first time again. Even though we have certain characteristics that people can identify with and feel comfortable in thinking, well, that must be Kusala. But then Kusala looks in the mirror and says, who the hell is that? And you just go, wow, we're always changing and morphing into something else, even though there's a continuity. There's a string that attaches all those beings and persons and selves together. But they're all different. They're all connected. It's unity and not oneness. And that's the challenge. Can we feel comfortable in the mystery? And if you've studied religion at all, there's a hell of a lot of mystery, and it's not well defined. Even if you have a PhD in philosophy and religion, the only people who will understand what you're saying are the three people in the audience who've studied the same thing. Other than that, they're going to go, what the hell is he talking about? You know? So it's skillful to live in the moment, and it is skillful to live in the mystery. Did that help at all?
That was okay.
Oh. Okay. Hi. You got it. Okay, well, how did the Buddha, with his karmic energy going over 1,000 lifetimes, how did he remember all that stuff? Is that somehow connected to the karmic energy? And it seems to be. There's something in Mahayana Buddhism called storehouse consciousness. In Theravada Buddhism, it's Vibhanga consciousness. And that seems to be the reservoir of our past lives and memories. And it said, when you achieve nirvana, you have access to that. The code is broken and you can go in and see what you used to do. So apparently there is some mechanism that connects the memories and the karmic energy and travels lifetime to lifetime. And Google could probably give you a more exact answer. You know, and I love Google now, because if you do a Google question, it always comes up with an AI. Yeah, the turtle through the yolk.
Yeah.
You know, yeah. Yeah, no, that's the question was, for people that couldn't hear him, was out there in YouTube land, that what is the likelihood of being like born on this planet? You know, and there's only 8 billion of us. Now, that sounds like a whole lot of people, and it is for one planet. But in the cosmos, it's just a speck, 8 billion. So what is the likelihood? Very rare. The likelihood is very rare that anybody would ever be born on Earth. And what does that say to you? That says to you, you've got some good karma, because you made it here. Now, what you make of that is up to you. But you got here. And now, will you be able to come back? You know, because there's work to be finished, and if you can't come back, you're not going to be able to finish your work. But will you remember the work that's unfinished when you come back? Probably not. You'll be starting over again, always for the first time. 6 realms of existence is useful in this. So we got 6 places. Overly simplified, that we can go. The first one is the heaven realm. It's the perfect realm. It's the perfect place to be. It's just what you want. But after a couple hundred thousand lifetimes, human lifetimes, you have to leave. It's not fair, because the karma that put you there finally wore out. And because you were in heaven, you couldn't create any new karma because everything was perfect. So you had to leave. And I can't think of anything more fundamentally sad than that, having to leave heaven. Now, the second heaven is not quite as good, because the second heaven has some desire connected to it. So it's never perfect. If only this were different, and if only that were different, it would be perfect. But it never gets this or that. So, and then you have to leave there as well. So you even have to leave the second heaven. And then the third place is human realm. Now, the human realm could be often looked at as not just humans, but beings, aliens and other planets and stuff, you know, and that kind of reality. And it's really hard to be born as a human being, and it's really hard to be born on Earth, and we made it, and we should just be thankful every day, filled with gratitude that we're here. Even though when you look at the news, you wonder why you should be grateful for being here, but there you go. First hell realm, the animal realm. And people say, no, that can't be. How could the animals be in hell realm? Well, the animal realm is where the animals only have 3 things in mind. They want to eat, they want to sleep, and they want to have sex. Sort of like a teenager, really. And that's all they do. They've got, you know, they can't do much more than that at all. And then you have the hungry ghost realm. And all these creatures are giant creatures with a pinhole for a mouth. And no matter how hard they try to put the food to the pinhole mouth, they're always hungry. They always want more. And when the sales come, they're the first in line, and they always want more stuff and more food and more excitement and more fun, and never satisfied. Hungry ghost realm. And then finally, the hell realm, the worst realm of all for a Buddhist to go to. And apparently, in this realm, you're recognizable. And so you can sort of look at yourself and identify, and you can look at your friends and relatives who are also in the hell realm with you. And then you're walking through the forest, and all of a sudden all the leaves fall off the trees and turn into razor blades and cut you into 1,000 pieces. And then you scream and yell because it's so painful. And then right on the spot, you're resurrected again to be killed again and resurrected and killed. And it just goes on and on and on until finally the karma that puts you in the hell realm wears out and you can go up now. You can go to a different place. So in the context of the six realms of existence, there are plenty of places to go. And then with the hopes that one day you will finally achieve nirvana and not have to go through all this stuff ever again. And nirvana is supposed to be really good. It's supposed to be peaceful and sort of poetic, and it's just energy, and it probably feels good, and who knows what it is. The Buddha never shared with us. So that's what I would say. I would say, yes, it's difficult to be born as a human being, and we should be grateful every day that we made it. And be of service to those who are in the other realms of existence, like the animal realm, and maybe feed them or pet them or make sure they're okay, that kind of stuff, because that adds to our merit, it adds to our karma, and almost allows us to have a better rebirth because of our kindness and our sensitivity.